Good morning. Yeah. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Why are we up so fucking early? I mean, how important can this speech be if we're giving it at noon? It can't be that important. Every decent musician in town is asleep. Or they will be before I'm done with this thing. I guarantee you. I got a bit of a mess up here, but when I was invited to do the keynote speech at this year's conference, I was a little hesitant. Because the word keynote made me uncomfortable. It seemed to suggest that there was a keynote to be struck that sums up whatever's going on out there in the streets. 5 days of bans, hundreds of venues from morning to night, and no one really hardly agrees on anything in pop anymore. There is no keynote, I don't think. There's no unified theory of everything. You can ask Einstein. But you can pick any band, say Kiss, and you can go early theater rock proponents expressing the true raging hormones of youth, or they suck. You can go Fish, inheritors of the Grateful Dead's mantle, brilliant center of a true alternative community, or they suck. You go Bruce Springsteen, natural born poetic genius off the streets of Monmouth County. Hardest working New Jerseyan in show business, voice of the common man, future of rock and roll, or he sucks. Get the fuck out of here. You could pick any band and create your own equation. It's fun. There was even a recent book that focused on the Beatles and decided, you got it, they sucked. So, really, instead of a keynote speech, I thought perhaps there should be a keynotes speech, or perhaps many keynote speakers. I exaggerate for effect, but only a little bit. So, with that as my disclaimer, I move cautiously on. Still, it's great to be in a town with 10,000 bands, or whatever, anybody know the actual number? Come on. A lot of them, right? Back in late 64, when I picked up the guitar, that would have seemed like some insane teenage pipe dream. Because first of all, it would have been numerically impossible. There just weren't that many guitars to go around in those days. They simply hadn't made that many yet. It was we would all have to have been sharing. Guitar players were rare, mostly music school, and bands were rare. And until the Beatles hit, played primarily instrumental music. And there wasn't that much music to play. When I picked up the guitar, there was only 10 years of rock history to draw on. That'd be like all of known pop being only the music that you know that's occurred between 2002 and now. The most groups in one place I'd ever seen as a teenager was 20 bands at the Keyport Matawan Rollerdrome in a battle to the death. So many styles were overlapping at that point in time that you would have a doo-wop singing group with full pompadours and matching suits set up next to our band playing a garage version of Them's Mystic Eyes, set up next to a full 13-piece soul show band. And still, that's nothing minutely compared to what's going on the streets of Austin right now. So it's incredible to be back. I've had a lot of fun here in Austin since the 70s and Jim Franklin and the Armadillo World Headquarters. And so it's fascinating to see what's become of the music that I've loved my whole life. Pop's become, I guess, a new language, cultural force, social movement, actually a series of new languages, cultural forces, and social movements that have inspired and enlivened second half of the 20th century and the dawning years of this one. I mean, who would have thought there would have been a sax-playing president or a soul-singing president, you know? When we started, 30 years old for a rock musician was unthinkable. You know, Bill Haley kept his age a relative secret, so when Danny and the Juniors sang Rock and Roll's Here to Stay, they didn't have a clue as to how terrifyingly fucking right they were going to be. You know, when I look out from my stage these days, I look into the eyes of three generations of people, and still popular music continues to provide its primary function as youth music, as a joyous argument starter, and as a subject for long, booze-filled nights of debate with Steve Van Zandt over who reigns ultimately supreme. There are so many subgenres and factions: two-tone, acid rock, alternative dance, alternative metal, alternative rock, art punk, art rock, avant-garde metal, black and death metal, Christian metal, heavy metal, funk metal, glam metal, medieval metal, indie metal, melodic death metal, melodic black metal, metalcore, hardcore, electronic hardcore, folk punk, folk rock, pop punk, Brit pop, grunge, sadcore, surf music, psychedelic rock, punk rock, hip hop, rap rock, rap metal, Nintendo core, huh? I just want to know what Nintendo core is myself. But rock noir, shock rock, skate punk, noise core, noise pop, noise rock, pagan rock, paisley underground, indie pop, indie rock, heartland rock, roots rock, samba rock, screamo, emo, shoegazing, stoner rock, swamp pop, synth pop, rock against communism, garage rock, blues rock, death and roll, lo-fi, jangle pop, folk music. Just add neo and post to everything I said and mention them all again. Rock and roll. So, holy shit, this is all going on in this town right now. For a guy who realizes U2 is probably the last band he's going to know the names of all four members of, it's overwhelming. So, perhaps the most prophetic comment I've heard over the past quarter century about rock music was made by Lester Bangs upon Elvis's death. And in 1977, Lester Bangs said Elvis was probably the last thing we were all going to agree on, Public Enemy not counting. From here on in, you would have your heroes and I'd have mine. The center of your world may be Iggy Pop or Joni Mitchell or maybe Dylan. Mine might be Kiss or Pearl Jam, but we would never see eye to eye again and be brought together by one music again. And his final quote in the article was, so instead of saying goodbye to Elvis, I'm going to say goodbye to you. And while that's been proven 1,000 times over, still here we are in a town with thousands of bands, each with a style and philosophy and a song of their own. And I think the best of them believe that they have the power to turn Lester's prophecy inside out and to beat his odds. So as the records that my music was initially released on give way to a cloud of ones and zeros, and as I carry my entire record collection since I was 13 in my breast pocket, I'd like to talk about the one thing that's been consistent over the years: the genesis and power of creativity, the power of the songwriter, or let's say composer, or just creator. So whether you're making dance music, Americana, rap music, electronica, it's all about how you're putting what you do together. The elements you're using don't matter. Purity of human expression and experience is not confined to guitars, to tubes, to turntables, to microchips. There is no right way, no pure way of doing it. There's just doing it. We live in a... We live in a post-authentic world. And today, authenticity is a house of mirrors. It's all just what you're bringing when the lights go down. It's your teachers, your influences, your personal history. And at the end of the day, it's the power and purpose of your music that still matters. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about how I put what I've done together in the hopes that someone slugging away in one of the clubs tonight may find some small piece of it valuable. And this being Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday and the centerpiece of this year's South by Southwest Conference, I'm also going to talk a little bit about my musical development and where it intersected with Woody's and why. In the beginning, every musician has their genesis moment. For you, it might have been the Sex Pistols or Madonna or Public Enemy. It's whatever initially inspires you to action. Mine was 1956, Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was the evening I realized a white man could make magic, that you did not have to be constrained by your upbringing, by the way you looked, or by the social context that oppressed you. You could call upon your own powers of imagination, and you could create a transformative self. A certain type of transformative self that perhaps at any other moment in American history might have seemed difficult, if not impossible. And I always tell my kids that they were lucky to be born in the age of reproducible technology. Otherwise, they'd be traveling in the back of a wagon and I'd be wearing a jester's hat. So, you know, the advent, it's all about timing. It's all about timing. The advent of television and its dissemination of visual information changed the world in the 50s the way the internet has over the past 20 years. Remember, it wasn't just the way Elvis looked, it was the way he moved that made people crazy, pissed off, driven to screaming ecstasy, and profane revulsion. That was television. When they made an attempt to censor him from the waist down, it was because of what you could see happening in his pants. Elvis was the first modern 20th century man. He was a precursor of the sexual revolution, of the civil rights revolution, drawn from the same Memphis as Martin Luther King, creating fundamental outsider art that would be embraced by a mainstream popular culture. Television and Elvis gave us full access to a new language, a new form of communication, a new way of being, a new way of looking, a new way of thinking about sex, about race, about identity, about life, a new way of being an American, a human being, and a new way of hearing music. Once Elvis came across the airwaves, once he was heard and seen in action, you could not put the genie back in the bottle. After that moment, there was yesterday, and there was today, and there was a red-hot rockabilly forging of a new tomorrow before your very eyes. So, 1 week later, inspired by the passion in Elvis's pants, my little six-year-old fingers wrapped themselves around a guitar neck for the first time, rented from Mike Deal's Music in Freehold, New Jersey. They just wouldn't fit. Failure with a capital F. So I just beat on it and beat on it and beat on it in front of the mirror, of course. I still do that. But don't you? Come on. You gotta check your moves. But even before there was Elvis, my world had begun to be shaped by the little radio with a 6-inch mono speaker that sat on top of our refrigerator. My mother loved music and she raised us on pop music radio. So between 8 and 8:30 every morning, as I snowed sugar onto my sugar pops, the sounds of early pop and doo-wop whispered into my young and impressionable ears. Doo-wop, the most sensual music
ever made. The sound of raw sex, of silk stockings rustling on backseat upholstery. The sound of the snaps of bras popping across the USA. Of wonderful lies being whispered into taboo perfumed ears. The sound of smeared lipstick, untucked shirts, running mascara, tears on your pillow, secrets whispered in the still of the night, the high school bleachers in the dark at the YMCA canteen, the soundtrack for your incredibly wonderful limp your ass blue balled walk back home after the dance. Oh! It hurts so good. In the late 50s and early 60s, doo-wop dripped from radios in the gas stations, factories, streets, and pool halls, the temples of life and mystery in my little hometown. And I would always be enraptured by its basic chord progression. Isn't there supposed to be a guitar out here? Anybody got one?
Yes. Oh. I don't really need it, but
it was just that. Kiss somebody? And it became one soft and fist in summer. Me and Terry became friends. It's all comes from the same place. But anyway. Then into my 13-year-old ears came 60s pop, Roy Orbison. Besides Johnny Cash, he was the other man in black. He was the true master of the romantic apocalypse you dreaded and knew was coming after the first night you whispered, "I love you," to your new girlfriend. You were going down. Roy was the coolest, uncool loser you'd ever seen, with his Coke bottle black glasses, his three-octave range. He seemed to take joy sticking his knife deep into the hot belly of your teenage insecurities. Simply the titles, Crying, It's Over, Running Scared. That's right, the paranoia. Oh, the paranoia. He sang about the tragic unknowability of women. He was tortured by soft skin, Angora sweaters, beauty and death, just like you. But he also sang that he'd been risen to the heights of near unexpressible bliss by these same very things that tortured him. Oh, cruel irony. And for those few moments, he told you that the wreckage and the ruin and the heartbreak was all worth it. "I got it," my young songwriter's wisdom said to me. "Life is tragedy, broken by moments of unworldly bliss that make that tragedy bearable." I was half right. That wasn't life, that was pop music. But at 24, who knew the difference? So I was on my way. Then Spectre, the wall of sound. Phil's entire body of work could be described by the title of one of his lesser known productions. He hit me and it felt like a kiss. Phil's records felt like near chaos, violence covered in sugar and candy, sung by the girls who were sending Royo running straight for the antidepressants. If Roy was opera, Phil was symphonies, little three-minute orgasms followed by oblivion. And Phil's greatest lesson was sound, sound, sound is its own language. I mean, the first thing you would think of a Phil Spector is... That was all you needed. And then, the British invasion. My first real guitar, I actually began to learn how to play. And this was different, shifted the lay of the land. Four guys playing and singing, writing their own material. There was no longer going to be a music producer apart from the singer, a singer who didn't write, a writer who didn't sing. It changed the way things were done. The Beatles were cool, they were classical, formal, and created the idea of an independent unit where everything could come out of your garage. The Meet the Beatles album cover, those four headshots, I remember I seen them at J.J. Newbery's. It was the first thing I saw when you ran down to the 5 and 10 cent store. There were no record stores. There weren't enough records, I don't think, in those days. There was like a little set, you know, by the toys where they sold a few albums. I remember running in and seeing that album cover with those four headshots. It was like, the silent gods of Olympus. You know, your future just sort of staring you in the face. And I remember thinking, that's too cool. I'm never going to get there, man. Never. And then in some fanzine, I came across a picture of the Beatles in Hamburg. And they had on the leather jackets and the slick back pompadours and they had acneed faces. I said, hey, wait a minute, those are the guys I grew up with. You know, they were the Liverpool wharf rats. So minus their Nehru jackets and the haircuts. So these guys, they're kids. They're a lot cooler than me, but they're still kids. There must be a way to get there from here. And then for me, it was the Animals. For some, they were just another one of the really good beat groups that came out of the 60s. But to me, the Animals were a revelation. They were the first records with full-blown class consciousness that I'd ever heard. We got to get out of this place. It had that great bass riff, you know, it had that. And that was just the clock, man, the clock marking time, you know. In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no sense in trying. My little girl, you're so young and pretty. One thing I know is true. You'll be dead before your time is due. This I know. See my daddy in bed and dying. See his hair turning gray. He's been working and slaving his life away. Yes, I know. It's been work every day. Just work every day. It's been work, 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 work. We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Yes, I know it's true. That's every song I've ever written. Yeah. I
That's all of them. I'm not kidding either. That's Born to Run, Born in the USA. Everything I've done for the past 40 years, including all the new ones, you know? But that struck me so deep. It was the first time I felt I heard something come across the radio that mirrored my home life, my childhood. And the other thing that was great about the Animals was there were no good-looking members. There were none. They were considered to be one of the ugliest groups in all of rock and roll. And that was good. That was good for me because I considered myself hideous at the time. And they weren't nice, you know, they didn't curry favor. You know, they were like aggression personified. It's my life. I'll do what I want, you know. They were cruel. They were cruel, which was so freeing. It was so freeing. When you saw Eric Burdon, looked like a shrunken, like your shrunken daddy with a wig on, you know? he never had a kid's face. He always had a little man's face, you know? And he couldn't dance. He was like this. And they put him in a suit, but it was like putting a gorilla in a suit, you know? You could tell he fucked that shit, man. He didn't want it, you know? And then he had that voice that was like, I don't know, you know, Howlin' Wolf or something, coming out of some 17 or 18-year-old kid. I mean, I don't know how it happened, you know. But they were so, I found their cruelty so freeing, you know. What was that great verse in It's My Life? It's a hard world to get a break, and all the good things have been taken. You will make certain things. Though dressed in these rags, I'll wear a sable someday. Hear what I say. I'm going to ride the serpent. No time spent sweating rent. You know. And then that beautiful, It's My Life. Show me I'm wrong. Hurt me sometime. But someday I'll treat you real fine. I love that. Yes, 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 yes. You know? And then they had the name. The name was very different from the Beatles or Herman's Hermits or Freddie and the Dreamers. You know, the name was unforgiving and final and irrevocable. You know, it was in your face. It was the most unapologetic group name until the Sex Pistols came along. You know? Badlands, Prove It All Night. The darkness was filled with the animals. You know, I took, youngsters, watch this one. All right, I'm gonna tell you how it's done right now. I took Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. It's the same fucking riff, man. Listen up, youngsters. This is how successful theft is accomplished. Darkness was also informed by the punk explosion at the time. I went out and I got all the records, all the early punk records, and I brought Anarchy and UK Home, God Save the Queen, and the Sex Pistols were so frightening. You know, they shook the earth. You know, they were truly, which is different from shocking. You know, a lot of groups manage shocking, but frightening. Frightening was something else. There's very, very few rock groups that manage frightening. You know, and that was a great quality, and it was part of their great beauty. You know, they were brave, and they challenged you, and they made you brave, and a lot of that energy seeped its way into the subtext of Darkness. Darkness was written in 1977, and all of that music was out there. And if you had ears, you could not ignore it. And I had peers that did, and they were mistaken. You could not ignore that challenge, you know. And of course, for me, there was, of course, movies, films, that's another discussion, you know. But soul music, incredibly important. The blue collar grit of soul music. It was that I was brought up on a back street. I learned how to love
before I could eat. Now, even though I personally learned how to eat long before I knew how to love, you know, I knew what he was talking about, you know. It was the music of gritty determination, of the blues, of the church, of the earth, and of the sex-soaked heavens. It was music of sweaty perspiration and drenched demands for pleasure and respect. It was adult music. It was sung by soul men and women, not teen idols, you know. And then it was the silken sequined aspirational sounds of Motown. That was something smoother, but I was no less powerful than Stax, you know. It was the beautifully socially conscious soul of Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions. We're a winner. Keep on pushing. You know, just great, great records that just filled the airwaves at a time when you couldn't have needed them more. You just couldn't have needed them more. You know, Woman's Got Soul. What a beautiful, beautiful record to win. You know, It's All Right. It was the soundtrack of the civil rights movement. It was here amongst these great African-American artists that I learned my craft. You know, you learned how to write, you learned how to arrange, you learned what mattered and what didn't, learned what a great production sounds like, you learned how to lead a band, learned how to front a band. These men and women, they were and they remain my masters. And by the time I reached my 20s, I'd spent 1,000 nights employing their lessons in local clubs and bars, honing my own skills. I was signed as an acoustic singer-songwriter, but I was a wolf in sheep's clothing. Signed by John Hammond at Columbia Records, along with Elliot Murphy, John Prine, Loudon Wainwright III, we were all new Dillons. The old Dillon was only 30. So I don't even know why they needed a fucking new Dillon. All right? But those were the times. 30 was, you know. But I had nights and nights of bar playing behind me to bring my songs home. Young musicians learn how to bring it live and then bring it night after night after night after night. Your audience will remember you. Your ticket is your handshake. And the ability, these skills gave me a huge ace up my sleeve. And when we finally went on the road and we played that ace, we scorched the earth, because that's what I was taught to do by Sam Moore and by James Brown. There is no greater performance than James Brown burning ass on the Rolling Stones at the Tammy Show. Sorry, my friends. And I fucking love the Stones, but James Brown, boys and men, you know, you were screwed. Yeah, I think I'll go on after James Brown. Oh yeah, can you put me in the schedule somewhere after James Brown? Fuck, no! Get out, go home, save it. Don't waste it, man. I had a great thing with James Brown. I went to see James Brown one night, and he kind of knew me. I was sitting in the audience, and suddenly I heard, "Ladies and gentlemen, Magic Johnson," and Magic Johnson was on stage. And ladies and gentlemen, Woody Harrelson. And he was on stage. And then I'm sitting in my seat watching, and I hear, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Born in the USA." You know? And I realized he didn't know my name, but he knew. So I ran my ass up there as fast as I could. I can't tell you, man. Standing on stage alongside of James Brown, you know, it was like, fuck, what am I doing here, you know? You know, it was just,
And we just went and went and went. But he's such a, his influence. James Brown, underrated, still today, underrated. You know. He's Elvis. He's Elvis. You know, he's Dylan. And then Dylan, from whom I first heard a version of the place that I lived that felt unvarnished and real to me. If you were young in the 60s and 50s, everything felt false everywhere you turned. But you didn't know how to say it. There was no language for it at the time. It just felt fucked up, you know? But you didn't have the words. Bob came along and gave us those words, you know? He gave us those songs, you know? And the first thing he asked you was, how does it feel, man? How does it feel, you know, to be on your own? And if you were a kid in 1965, you were on your own because your parents, God bless them, they could not understand the incredible changes that were taking place. You were on your own, you know, without a home. He gave us the words to understand our hearts, you know. He didn't treat you like a child. He treated you like an adult. He stood back and he took in the stakes that we were playing for. He laid them out in front of you. I never forgot it. And Bob is the father of my musical country now and forever. And I thank him, you know. But the great trick I learned from Bob, if it could be done, is he still does one thing that nobody can do. He sings verse after verse after verse after verse. It doesn't get boring. That's almost impossible. But Dylan wrote. He didn't write about something. He wrote about everything that mattered at once in every song. It seemed like. I said, yeah, I want to. You know, and he pulled it off. I said, yeah, I like that. I want to try that. So now I'm in my late 20s, and I'm concerned, of course, getting older, you know. I want to write music that I can imagine myself singing on stage at the advanced old age, perhaps, of 40, you know. I wanted to grow up, you know. I wanted to twist the form I loved into something that could address my adult concerns. And so I found my way to country music. I remember sitting in my little apartment, playing Hank Williams' greatest hits over and over. Right? And I was trying to crack its code, because at first it just didn't sound good to me. It just sounded cranky and old-fashioned, you know. But it was that hard country voice, and I'm playing it, and it was that austere instrumentation. But slowly, my ears became accustomed to its beautiful simplicity and its darkness and depth. And Hank Williams went from archival to alive for me before my very eyes. And I lived on that for a while in the late 70s. In country music, I found the adult blues, the working men's and women's stories I'd been searching for, the grim recognition of the chips that were laid down against you. My bucket's got a hole in it. I'll never get out of this world alive. Lost Highway. The great Charlie Rich song, life has its little ups and downs. Like ponies on a merry-go-round. No one grabs a brass ring every time, but she don't mind. Oh, fuck, man. That was like, she wears a gold ring on her finger, and it's mine. Oh, my God. You know, that was, that could reduce me to tears now. You know, it was so much, man's, working man's blues, stoic recognition of everyday reality and the small and big things that allow you to put a foot in front of the other and get you through. I found that country's fatalism attracted me. It was reflective, it was funny, it was soulful. But it was quite fatalistic, you know. Tomorrow looked pretty dark. And one thing it was rarely politically angry, or it was rarely politically critical. And I realized that fatalism had a toxic element.
If rock and roll was a 7-day weekend, country was Saturday night hell raising, followed by heavy Sunday morning coming down. Guilt, guilt, guilt. I fucked up. Oh my God. You know, but as the song says, would you take another chance on me? That was country. Country seemed not to question why. It seemed like it was about doing, then dying, screwing, then crying, booze, then trying, you know? And as Jerry Lee Lewis, the living, breathing personification of both rock and country, said, I've fallen to the bottom and I'm working my way down, you know? So that was hardcore working man's blues, hardcore. Loved it. An answer to Hank Williams' question, why does my bucket have a hole in it? Why? So along with our fun and the bar band raucousness, the E Street Band carried, search for identity and became a central part of my music. You know, and country by its nature appealed to me. Country was provincial, and so was I. I was not downtown. I wasn't particularly bohemian or hipster. I was kind of hippie by circumstance when it happened, you know. But I felt I was an average guy, you know, with a slightly above average gift. And if I worked my ass off on it, and country was about the truth emanating out of your sweat, out of your local bar, your corner store. It held its gaze on yesterday's blues, tonight's pleasures, and maybe on Sunday, the hereafter. And I covered a lot of ground, but there was still something missing. So somewhere in my late 20s, I picked up Joe Klein's Woody Guthrie of Life. And as I read that book, World of Possibilities, that predated Dylan's, that had inspired him and led to some of his greatest work, opened up for me. Woody's gaze was, it was set on today's hard times, but also somewhere over the horizon, you know, there was something. Woody's world was a world where fatalism was tempered by a practical idealism. It was a world where speaking truth to power wasn't futile, whatever its outcome, you know. Why do we continue to talk about Woody so many years on, never had a hit, never went platinum, never played in an arena, never had his picture on the cover of Rolling Stone, you know? But he's a ghost in the machine, big, big ghost in the machine. And I believe it's because Woody's songs, his body of work, tried to answer Hank Williams' question, why your bucket has a hole in it. And that's a question that's eaten at me also for a long time. So in my early 30s, his voice spoke to me very, very deeply. And we began to cover This Land Is Your Land in concert. Now, I knew I was never going to be Woody Guthrie. I liked Elvis. I liked the pink Cadillac too much. I like the simplicity and the tossed off temporary feeling of pop hits. I like big fucking noise. And in my own way, I like the luxuries and the comforts of being a star. I'd already gone a long way down a pretty different road. So 4 years ago, I found myself in an unusual situation. It was a cold winter day. And I was standing alongside of Pete Seeger. It was 25 degrees. Pete had come to Washington. Pete carries a banjo everywhere he goes, the subway, the bus, and comes out in his shirt. I said, man, Pete, you put on a jacket, man. It's freezing out here. 90 years old. 90 years old. Living embodiment of Woody's legacy. And there were several hundred thousand of our fellow citizens in front of us. We had the Lincoln Memorial behind us. And newly elected president to our right, and we were going to sing, "This Land Is Your Land," in front of all these Americans. And Pete insisted, said, "No," he says, we have to sing all the verses. We have to sing all the verses, man. We can't leave any of them out." I said, "But you know, the kid, I don't, Pete, there's only, we had like a crowd of like 6-year-old school kids behind us." He says, "No, we're all gonna sing all the verses, all the verses." And so we got to it. "As I was walking, I saw a sign there. On that sign said, no trespassing. And on the other side, didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me. This land is your land. Land is my land." This song's meant to be sung by everybody. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. So, on that day, Pete and myself and generations of young and old Americans, all colors, religious beliefs, I realized that sometimes things that come from the outside, they make their way in to become a part of the beating heart of the nation. And on that day, when we sung that song, Americans young and old, black and white, of all religious and political beliefs, were united for a brief moment by Woody's poetry. So, perhaps Lester Bangs wasn't completely right, for here we all are tonight in this town together, musicians young and old, celebrating each perhaps in our own way, a sense of freedom that was Woody's legacy. So, rumble, young musicians, rumble. Open your ears and open your hearts. Don't take yourself too seriously. And take yourself as seriously as death itself. Don't worry. Worry your ass off. Have ironclad confidence, but doubt. It keeps you awake and alert. Believe you are the baddest ass in town. And you suck. It keeps you honest. Be able to keep two completely contradictory ideas alive and well inside of your heart and head at all times. If it doesn't drive you crazy, it will make you strong. And stay hard, stay hungry, and stay alive. And when you walk on stage tonight to bring the noise, treat it like it's all we have. And then remember, it's only rock and roll. I think I may go out and catch a little black death metal. Thank you.